Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, May 3rd, the final day of the legislative session. At this hour, state lawmakers are winding up the people's business. We talk about housing for Maui as the governor is wasting no time signing a bill into law to tighten up on short-term rentals. The Environmental Protection Agency talks about water sampling and the behind-the-scenes work to keep our drinking water safe. A Norwegian cruise line ship got the dry dock treatment at Pearl Harbor recently. We learn how it impacts jobs here and the military's timeline for updating the shipyard. And the return of Shogun, the FX remake, was created by two Maui residents. They share what it took to bring the epic to the screen, and they share a great story about bringing their kids to the set. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Governor Josh Green is expected to sign a bill to help counties better manage short-term rentals. The issue has been a sensitive one, particularly for Maui. Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel joins us now. And Catherine, you were at a news conference with Mayor Bisson, and he detailed his plan.
He did. So earlier this week, Senate Bill 2919 passed both the House and the Senate. And as you mentioned, it will be signed by Governor Green today. And this is a state law that gives backing to counties to control short-term rentals in different ways. So Mayor Bisson said that he's been considering a county bill for a while, but with this state backing the county's regulation of STRs, they're ready to move forward with that. And he talked about this at his news conference. He's proposing a county bill that will tackle the minatoya list, which is a list of short-term rentals that were sort of grandfathered in, but had previously been used as workforce housing. So this list has been an issue of contention, particularly on Maui lately. Lahaina Strong is a grassroots organization that's been working really hard to raise awareness of this and had a very, you know, strong voice at the conference as well alongside the mayor. And Mayor Bisson said that they anticipate a legal battle in regulating short-term rentals, and this state law that's being signed today is just adding a stronger argument to the case and puts them in a better legal position moving forward. Here's Bisson talking about what the proposed county bill would do.
We're announcing our intent to present proposed legislation to all county planning commissions to revert all apartment district properties to their intended long-term residential use by removing the exception provided to those properties built or approved prior to 1989 and fully discontinue transient vacation rentals use in apartment districts by July 1st, 2025. That's for West Maui. TVRs and all other Maui County will be by January 1st, 2026. It is important to note that most, if not all, of these TVRs impacted by this legislation were previously built and designed for workforce housing in West Maui, and our goal is to return them to their intended purpose.
When he references TVRs, that's transient vacation rentals, correct?
Yes, transient vacation rentals are short-term rentals, and this would go into effect for West Maui on July 1st, 2025. So that's about a year away. And county staff talked a lot about, you know, the process that will go into getting an ordinance like this passed. Now, that would also go into effect for the rest of Maui on January 1st, 2026. So there is some time before this will happen for a sort of a phase out planning for those short-term rental owners who have units. And the bill will be heard at the June 24th Maui Planning Commission meeting. That will be the first time that county lawmakers will be discussing it officially. It will also go before the Lanai and the Molokai Planning Commissions for community comments from those communities. And it will continue to the Maui County Council for final consideration. And this will affect about 7,000 vacation rentals on Maui. And again, in that apartment district, those would be, you know, making the shift to the local housing market. it would affect about 2,200 units in West Maui specifically. County Councilmember Keone Rollins-Fernandez has championed caps and phase-outs, various ways to control short-term rentals for years, and she talks about the history of the properties affected by this proposed bill.
Our families are being uprooted and moving away every day. This bill sets out to accomplish the clear objective of prioritizing housing opportunities for our residents over the interests of offshore investors. Mahalo to Mayor Bisson and his administration for working with council members, Lahaina Strong, and the broader community to make immediate action to correct an injustice that commodifying our apartment units has had in the county since the 80s. In the 80s, offshore investors were buying up condos to capitalize on the vacation rental market here on Maui. This rapidly reduced housing inventory. In response, the council in 1989 attempted to limit STRs to the hotel zone where it should be. In 1991, that council clarified the restriction on short-term rentals for all properties built after 91 that were not zone hotel. The Deputy Corporation Counsel, Richard Minatoya, authored an opinion negating the 1991 ordinance, providing an exemption to units built before March 4th, 1991, allowing the owners to continue profiting off the units since that time. In 2015, Mayor Arakawa and the council passed a law that codified Mr. Minatoya's opinion that this bill today seeks to repeal.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that history. But yeah, it's a really sensitive issue. But, you know, Maui just finds itself in this terrible housing crisis.
Yes, and the mayor said there are impacts if we take this action. There are impacts if we don't take this action. But at this point, they are prioritizing local, you know, local families, the local community, making sure that they're housed first. And they said the county is willing to accept the consequences moving forward with this. He said about 700 families are now still in hotels. That's down from, you know, 8,000 people originally in 46 hotels. And now about almost 1,800 people are in 8 hotels. So we've seen a big decrease in the number of folks that are still housed in hotels. There were 2 big housing projects for temporary modular housing that, you know, moved forward this week on Maui. One had a groundbreaking in Lahaina, and another family through the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement received their keys to their new property in Kahului as part of that development this week. So slowly but surely making progress. And, you know, Mayor Bisson said that this is one more step to getting families back home and taken care of.
And, you know, I know that the Lahaina Strong folks have really, you know, dug in their heels, you know, over this issue. What's the reaction?
Absolutely. They have championed this entire process, and really bringing those community voices to the forefront, I think, has been critical throughout this process. They are, you know, thrilled with the state bill passing, as well as, of course, the county proposed bill being announced. And, you know, it's a big win for the organization, for the community, as they consider it. And they talked yesterday about, you know, they have been at Kaanapali since November. They have been camped out on the beach, taking a stand for dignified housing for displaced fire survivors. And this is a huge step. And they have talked, they are planning to responsibly dismantle their camp on Kaanapali Beach moving forward and look to what's ahead.
All right, okay. And then I know we'll just have to see if there are any legal challenges that come down over this. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org.
HPR Generation Listen invites you to Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. It's an opportunity to connect with fellow public radio nerds in an evening of lively but friendly competition. Gen Listen connects younger listeners and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Connect with us in person at HPR Gen Listen Trivia. Sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
It's been a busy week. The Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, is in town for a change of command ceremony at the Indo-Pacific Command, just as a historic trial over fuel-contaminated water got underway this past Monday. Families are suing the military for damages dating back to the fuel spill at Red Hill in 2021. But the mystery of why current water sampling is showing levels of TPH, total petroleum hydrocarbons, in the military's water system is still making some uneasy. Is it a case of false positives due to a reaction to chlorine and using the wrong kind of test, which is the military's theory? We talked to the EPA's enforcement branch chief, Amy Miller, out of the Region 9 San Francisco office, about where things stand.
We had asked that they conduct a root cause analysis to figure out why there were so many TPH detections, because we had received so many complaints. You know, we want to make sure that there's not a problem with the drinking water system. And so the Navy did put together a team of experts to really dig in, and EPA and DOH did participate in some of those meetings, and they have produced what they call as a technical memo, which is their theory or hypothesis as to what is the cause of the TPH detections.
They were pointing to possibly some lab contamination and some chemical reactions related to chlorine in the water.
Yes, and so that is their hypothesis. And we have not had a chance to review the technical memo in detail. And in general, as we've been working with them on this issue, we have a general agreement that that might be the correct hypothesis as to what the problems are. But we want to have an opportunity to review the technical memo, and we also want to do our own independent investigation, and that's going to take some time to do. But our primary focus right now for EPA is getting the extended drinking water monitoring plan finalized and approved by the regulatory agencies.
So that's the plan, to extend the monitoring for another year. And you'll be requiring the military to do additional testing and sampling?
That's correct. We would like to see that there are additional steps taken when there is total petroleum hydrocarbons detected. And so this would have additional steps. And we are working with the Navy on what that's going to look like. It's not quite ready.
We're still waiting to see what the health department comes up with their independent analysis as well. But it is on people's minds. You know, just this week we had the trial for the fuel spill from 2.5 years ago, you know, get underway. And there's just lots of concern about, is there anything that's still in the water? And I know the military believes that, you know, it's not fuel, that it's clear from the fuel. But you do want to get, like you said, to the root cause.
Indeed. You know, they have been meeting all of the regulatory requirements under the Safe Drinking Water Act. But it is worrisome, these total petroleum hydrocarbon detections and the amount of detections that they had over a period of time. And so we want to make sure that there isn't any cause for concern. Also, we received a lot of complaints at the same time. And so just in ensuring that, you know, we're checking under every rock and to make sure that there isn't any additional problems ongoing with the drinking water system.
And then what can you say about the ongoing efforts to close Red Hill? The military is looking at trying to put aside some of the water that they're flushing to clean the tanks, you know, now that they're drained.
Yes, work is underway right now, and I can go through a few of the items. First, the Navy Closure Task Force, the first thing that they have done is they have removed the AFFF concentrate, which was used for firefighting at Red Hill, from the facility. And we had inspectors on site, and they removed about 1,000 gallons. That was completed on April 15th. You may recall last year, before the defueling happened, there was like a lot of work underway putting together plans for defueling. And that's very similar to what we're doing right now, is we're reviewing a lot of their work plans to get ready to clean the tanks. And so we have been reviewing the tank cleaning work plan, including how they're planning to manage the waste. And so we've been going back and forth with them about requirements for disposal of waste that comes from the cleaning. We've also been reviewing their plan to verify that the tanks are clean. And so we've been going back and forth on exactly what is the standard for a clean tank. In addition, the Department of Health has been working with the Navy on an air quality monitoring plan. And so there is work that is underway to make sure that when the tank cleaning happens and there's venting, that the air is being monitored and that the community is protected from venting. And then we're expecting in the near future a plan for the pipeline removal. And so that's another big task that will be happening soon.
So a lot of the work that's underway is really pretty tedious. It's very technical. You've got to go back and double check and try and figure out if the plan forward is sound enough.
Yes, every single step of the way, we've asked for them to develop plans. We review it, then they implement it, and we have staff, both EPA and DOH staff, on site as they actually implement the plan to ensure that there are no accidents and that things are going according to plan.
Any other system in place for checks and balances? I asked that because I know in the lawsuit, there was a depot taken by the fuels director, the former fuels director, and there was concern that, you know, there was some reluctance to call in the regulators when there had been a spill, and concerned that, oh, this wasn't reportable, and then to find out that it was, and it was larger than they had let the regulators know initially. I don't know. Anything you want to say about that?
Yes. So for verification purposes, U.S. EPA and the Department of Health have people on site almost every single day in which activities are happening. We've place-based staff in Hawaii so that they're there and can technically oversee. We never did that in the past, and we understand the heightened risk here and making sure that the job gets done appropriately with intensive regulatory oversight.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, I don't know, how far back did you actually do this?
We started having staff on site during the defueling. From the day they began defueling, we had EPA staff on site, and throughout the defueling, every single day, there was EPA staff and Department of Health staff.
That's reassuring. Anything else you want to add just about this process and what the view is from where you sit as a regulator?
You know, we're very anxious to see the cleaning get started and get that underway. It's going to take a couple years, and so it's really important that we get it all figured out and start implementing to get it to the ultimate closure. One other thing I'll mention is some big plans are expected with respect to remediation, including remediating the groundwater. And so those plans are coming in June from the Navy. And so both EPA and Department of Health are really looking forward to start working on cleaning up the groundwater. And the first step is analyzing all the potential concerns and sources, and then coming up with a remediation plan.
And then I don't know if you've had a chance to chat with Board of Water Supply at all, but I just recall in our conversations, about a month or two ago, that they had said that they hadn't had any issues with the chlorination, when they do their regular tests of the Board of Water Supply water system?
We are in touch with Ernie and the Board of Water Supply to discuss their concerns. One thing I will say about the total petroleum hydrocarbon, it's not a drinking water test. It's a test used in other programs to detect total petroleum hydrocarbons. You usually don't see that in drinking water. So applying it in a drinking water system, you know, you do need to take that step of dechlorinating the water in order to get a clear analysis. It's important that, you know, we do this and, you know, we're taking this responsibility very seriously. And that is why EPA has spent a lot of time working with the Navy on their emergency response plan, including notifying the regulators. That is a crucial part, you know, to minimize and also get the regulators there on site when there is a spill so that we can start working on solutions immediately.
That was Amy Miller, who is with the Region on Enforcement Branch of the EPA. The Red Hill crisis launched a number of probes, including a recent one by the Defense Department's Inspector General that last month found deficiencies with the Defense Logistics Agency's oversight over several fuel facilities across the world. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. This morning, we're digging into archives from the territory of Hawaii to attest your aviation history, spotlighting a couple of young pioneers affectionately dubbed Birdmen. The moniker appeared in a 1910 article published by the Pacific Commercial Advertiser. It referenced teen brothers Albert and Malcolm Tuttle, who had moved to the islands with their parents just 3 years prior. The youth loved to surf. They excelled in science and studied aviation at Punahou. They also helped build the family's Sixth Avenue home in Kaimuki. One summer, the Tuttles were inspired to build their own glider after reading an article with detailed directions in their mother's Woman's Home Companion magazine. Their father funded the project, and the pair successfully built and tested their glider. It measured 15 feet long and 18 feet across, and it weighed 40 pounds. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know where the Bird Boys of Hawaii ran their tests. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NereidHawaii.com.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jude Curravan, author of The Cosmic Hologram, In Formation at the Center of Creation. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the unified nature of reality.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, offering courses for ages 50 and older, now with new community college locations. Summer term begins June 3rd. More by searching OLLIUHM.
Well, Well, it doesn't happen very often, but it can be done. This past weekend, a cruise ship paid a rare visit to the Pearl Harbor dry dock for maintenance. Normally, it's the Navy ships that take priority on base, but it just happened a window was available, enough time for the Norwegian Cruise Line's Pride of America to get a tune-up, something that normally would have to happen on the West Coast. We talked to Pacific Shipyard International. The company was founded in Hawaii in the 1940s, and thanks to a public-private partnership, workers were able to get the cruise ship in on a quick turnaround in Friday and out by Sunday. We talked to CEO Ian Wood and Vice President Troy Kepper yesterday afternoon. Wood starts us off.
You know, from our business perspective, it's, you know, good core work for us as a ship repair company. It's good work for the private ship repair industry in Hawaii, so it brings work, you know, to other companies as well to help support the endeavor. And then we don't know specifics with Norwegian Cruise Line's business as far as how that directly affects their revenue stream, but could imagine that if they had to take the ship to the mainland or elsewhere, that could potentially impact their cruises and their passenger numbers quite a bit and, you know, disrupt the business flow. So helping facilitate it to stay here in Hawaii, I think, is a win-win. Keeps the passengers in Hawaii, and, you know, monies are being spent to cruise in Hawaii and spend monies here. So there's local monies going into the local economy. So there's a lot of win-win in this arrangement.
And Choi, kind of walk us through this. I mean, this was a window where you weren't really servicing military ships. So, you know, are the crews just sitting idle? How does that work?
To kind of use Ian's same term, I can't speak on behalf of the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard and their workload. The term low utilization period, which is language that's in the public-private partnership, that simply means that, to use Ian's term, we're looking for a window of opportunity to dry dock the Pride of America in the Navy's dry dock. So we identified that time, you know, a few months ago with the Navy to get them to agree to say, yes, this window of opportunity looks good. It's a low utilization period, not to mean that the Navy is having any low utilization period. They're very busy right now, Pearl Harbor, with all the modernization work going on there. But it's just a window of opportunity. So we kind of coordinate that with the Navy. And then the public-private partnership is very specific for that event to coordinate the dry dock event for that weekend. So
I imagine, though, the planning that goes into this, that, yeah, it's a lot of planning, pre-planning.
Well over a year of planning. And I mean, we have to comply with a lot of requirements that the Navy has to comply with, everything from environmental standards to just their operations. And it's a joint effort between us being the company that NCL comes to help coordinate this whole thing. And we're providing labor to help bring the dock in, as well as Pearl Harbor. They're bringing all of their shipwrights in. They're actually the ones who are setting the blocks and arranging the blocks in the dock. So it's been a long collaborative effort that, yeah, it was maybe over a year, Ian. It wasn't from the time we first started planning this with NCL to starting to have, you know, almost weekly conference calls with Navy leadership summertime of 2023.
Like Troy said, it definitely started over a year ago. But actually, if you even go back further, the relationship with Norwegian Cruise Lines goes back probably over a decade or more when they took over the cruise ships for American Hawaii Cruises, you know, bought them out of bankruptcy, finished the vessels, and, you know, really made a commitment to doing the maintenance in Hawaii. And we've been doing this, you know, through Pacific Shipyards over a number of dry dockings. Some are very short, like this one was docked on a Friday and undocked on a late Saturday night, Sunday morning. And then other dockings have run as long as, you know, up to about 2 weeks with a lot more work going on. So for them to keep their work here in Hawaii means a lot. And I'd say it's a bit of a handshake agreement. The day before the docking, we signed the contract. And so I'd say it was more of a formality getting down there. But we've been working on a handshake over the last year, you know, planning and preparing things. And it's based on that relationship. It's ultimately needed a contract to get this done, but the public-private partnership and the contract with NCL really came down to the last couple of days. But a lot of work had been going into planning and getting ready for this for many, many months leading up to it.
And Troy, can you talk about, I don't know, security? You know, because, you know, usually when you hear, you know, the work is underway on the base, you know, things are extra tight.
Yes, so security getting into the area, getting on the base is, of course, tight, and then getting into that controlled industrial area where Dry Dock 4 is an additional level of security to get in. So, of course, we had to work with Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard, you know, and get access during, again, a very specific window of time. You know, we worked with them to make sure that the crew that came in with the vessel were, you know, they basically, most of the crew stayed on the ship over the course of the weekend, so we were super thankful for, you know, the crew that lived on the ship for the weekend and sat tight while it was going through the very quick, you know, survey. It is, high security, and it was just a matter of paperwork and making sure that we go through the right avenues. But ultimately, it just came down to a lot of communication to make sure that they had the security guards set up and we had the right paperwork done and badges to show for access. And it went pretty smooth, actually.
And then how does this work with the modernization of the docks over the next 3 years, right? Because there's a big push to get all the construction there completed in this time frame. Does that mean, you know, then there's going to be less availability to do things like this?
I'll try and take that one. That's a tough question. But a little bit back more to the security is that there's a combination of crew on the ship that's, you know, I'd say roughly about 900 total crew members were with the ship, and majority of those were U.S. citizens, but there's also a good number of foreign nationals that work on the ship. So I think Pearl Harbor really goes out of their way to help facilitate this, even knowing that there's foreign nationals on board. That's all baked into the public-private partnership agreement on how we manage that and how we manage the foreign nationals being inside Pearl Harbor. So give them a lot of credit for how they work that.
Talk about what all this construction is going to mean. Will it mean fewer opportunities to do public-private partnerships like this?
I think with Dry Dock 3 going offline and to facilitate construction of Dry Dock 5, I believe it could contribute to, you know, restrictions on dry dock space generally. And as an industry in general, we've voiced our concerns with the Navy at large. Primarily, the discussion has been revolving around keeping the Navy ships here in Hawaii so that we don't lose the industrial capability, because the predominance of surface ship work in Pearl Harbor is done by private sector, through the private sector ship repair industrial base. And the concern generally that we've socialized with the Navy is when Dry Dock 5 construction starts and the Navy needs to dock submarines, they've indicated they will dock them in Dry Dock 4. And so with that, you will lose potentially that capability to dock surface ships in Pearl Harbor. The Navy's also said that they are working to bring another dry dock online, a floating dry dock, and they've had that in their plans for out years, and I say in the 2035 range, but they've also discussed more recently of bringing that forward into the, say, the 2028 timeframe, roughly, to make sure there's sufficient dry dock capacity online so that we don't lose the surface ship work basically to the West Coast. And that would also obviously then affect opportunities like this with cruise ships. I think industry has been working very hard to work and partner with the Navy in any way we can to help make sure that we preserve the capabilities to dock surface ships in Hawaii, and cruise ships fall into that category.
Yeah, a lot of moving parts with this one.
Yes, ma'am.
Anything else you want to underscore?
Troy, do you have any thoughts?
Ship repair and supporting the Navy is an emergent, ever-dynamic process of responding to either emergent needs or long-term planning, and we're happy to be able to squeeze in a quick little dry dock event that was highly unusual to bring a cruise ship into the Navy's dry dock, where just a slightly backwards arrangement where, you know, the Navy's kind of our customer in that sense, where it was a little bit backwards, you know. But no, you know, Pacific Shipyards as a major prime contractor to the Navy and the commercial industry, we're just happy to be able to kind of facilitate both sides and work with everybody to maintain any sort of floating asset in Hawaii and help the Navy keep their surface combatants operational.
That was Troy Kupper and Ian Wood from Pacific Shipyards International talking to us about a rare event that allowed a cruise ship to be serviced at the military's Pearl Harbor facility this past weekend.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Fashioning Aloha traces the history of Aloha wear from the 1930s to the present. Now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
What can a song contest tell us about Israel's relationship with Europe? This week, we're diving into Eurovision, Europe's massive song competition. We look at how a supposedly apolitical event can tell us so much about geopolitics. And we'll get into the drama surrounding Israel's participation this year. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Now it's time for your backyard quiz answer. Earlier we told you about brothers Albert and Malcolm Tuttle, Hawaii's first aviation pioneers. In an article dated October 30th, 1910, the Pacific Commercial Advertiser reported that the brothers successfully built and flew a glider. They were only 13 and 14 years old at the time. Soon after, they were dubbed Honolulu's first birdmen. Inspired by a magazine article, the teens built their glider in the summer of 1910. The pair went to Kaimuki Crater to test their work, which was the answer to today's backyard quiz. After several tries, the brothers got the glider to fly 10 feet through the air and 40 feet along the ground, and they captured the moment on camera. After the brothers graduated from Punahou in 1914, the Tuttle family left Hawaii. Albert became an Army Air Corps pilot, a lawyer, and later a judge in Atlanta, Georgia. Malcolm became a civil engineer. Over the years, others claimed to be the island's first aviators until 1966, when the book Above the Pacific confirmed the Tuttle brothers were the first. And we had no winners today. We stumped you on this one. But that was our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you help shine the spotlight on Hawaii's next generation of musicians.
How long have you been playing the violin?
I've been playing for about 7 years. I got my violin for Christmas when I was 6, and then I started playing probably a month after.
Hear from local students every Tuesday on HPR2's Classical Pacific.
I'd say just number one thing for really any musician, but even percussionists too, it's really just all about persistence and exactness. There will be times where, you know, you kind of get down about it, but there's always a light around the corner.
Help HPR uplift Hawaii's youngest musicians. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Shogun. You may remember the James Clavell novel that became a miniseries starring actor and part-time Hawaii resident Richard Chamberlain back in the 1980s. The 2024 remake of this historic drama just concluded a 10-episode run on the TV channel FX. And there is again a Hawaii connection. The new series was brought to the screen by the husband and wife team of Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo, who are Maui residents. Here's the trailer.
Do not be fooled by our politeness, our bows, our maze of rituals. Death is in our air, and sea and earth. Just remember, we live and we die. We control nothing beyond that.
There's a saying out here, every man has three hearts. One in his mouth for the world to know. Another in his chest, just for his friends. And a secret heart, buried deep, where no one can find it. What kind of man wields power in a land like this? The one in the open or the one you never see? Will I die here? Likely. Magari wa momenta ka no minorin jubagari cha.
War is coming.
Death are the same. Both can have value and purpose.
This is not where we die. We should be corpses by now, but here we are. My life is mine and yours is yours. If you can't see that, you'll never be free of this prison.
It is you who is imprisoned. Freedom is all you ever live for.
己の務めを果たす覚悟ができておるか?
Rachel Kondo grew up on the Valley Isle and graduated from Maui High School. And while Shogun is her first TV writing credit, her husband, Justin Marks, is credited with writing the 2016 Jungle Book remake and the story for 2022's Top Gun, Maverick. The Conversation's Russell Subiono got the chance to talk to the duo recently about the new adaptation.
What happened was we read this book, and it turns out the book is actually really surprising and really incredible and really ahead of its time when it comes to its modernity, especially when telling the Stranger in a Strange Land story. A lot of the stories that maybe have derived from it over the years haven't quite gotten the nuance that Shogun had. And so we thought there was an opportunity to tell the story today in a way that would celebrate that and be very loyal to the book, but also use the book as an opportunity to kind of tell it from a variety of lenses. So that was the starting point, at least for me.
I think the starting point for me was also the book. It was offered to Justin to consider coming on to a showrunner and writer. And I saw it on our kitchen table and thought, oh, I know that story, even though I hadn't read the book. Because in some way, it has seeped into our skin, right? This story we're weirdly all familiar with, but we don't know why. And so I immediately thought, well, naturally, I'm interested. I'm of Japanese heritage, so there's just that built-in curiosity. But it very quickly became clear that, as Justin said, nothing is as we expected. I very quickly had to learn being Japanese-American is completely different than being Japanese, emphasis on the word American. And the book was surprisingly propulsive. And for me personally, it was the female characters that ended up kind of lingering the longest. So that was my initial foray into this whole journey.
The book was written in 1975. The original miniseries came out in 1980. This is coming out in 2024. You know, they are all using the past as windows into their present. And we wanted to do the same with this adaptation in 2024, to use it as an opportunity to talk about the world we live in today in some ways, of this idea of intersectionality, this idea of how do we encounter other cultures or just others in general, and how do we encounter ourselves in that? So, you know, it's my greatest hope that someday, 44 years from now, someone is remaking this show and talking about the things we got wrong, because I'm sure they exist, you know what I mean? And
or even asking the same questions that we attempted to ask. You know, these were all the questions that James Clavell was asking. And I think it's important to note that had he not written this book and had the 1980 miniseries not been as affecting as it was, I don't think we could do the show we did. We stand on its shoulders, and it did the work it needed to do in order to set us up for a new conversation.
You know, back in February, Fandango screened the first two episodes at a movie theater in Kapolei, and I went along with some of my family. And in the time since, I've talked to several people who either are from Japan or very familiar with Japanese culture. The kind of theme through all of that is they've all remarked at how authentic everything is in the show, how it feels, how it looks. What kind of effort did you guys put into being as accurate and as authentic as possible?
Yeah, so much work went into this. This was 90% of the last 5 years of our lives was doing this. And I think it's interesting because you say accurate and authentic. We found in our process that there was a line between those two in a lot of regards. And the decision as to where we sat between accuracy and authenticity was a very, you know, a hard decision to come to through a long time. But, you know, we, with our collaboration with our Japanese partners on this project, Hiro Sanada, who's not just star of our show, but producer as well, Eriko Miyagawa, the countless Japanese crew, advisors, and cast who came over to British Columbia where we shot this to do it together. I mean, we had everyone from not just historians, language advisors, cultural advisors, Xhosa movement advisors.
Obi tires,
hair, makeup, art department consultants, garden designers, you know, everyone kind of working to render something that felt to them was reflective of the culture that they were raised in. I think that time and time again, what we found is That was a discussion as our understanding of history continues to grow. You know, some of these things are right and wrong, and how do we arbitrate as Westerners what is? You know, that really began to be a process of listening to your collaborators and sort of understanding how they would see it, not from the lens of storytellers, but through the lens of a Japanese audience too, mm-hmm. what they would accept. And the best I can think of is the great seating debate of 2021 when we shot this show. But how do characters sit in this world? Because there's a lot of historical evidence to demonstrate that women in the Sengoku Jidai, when our story takes place, sat in the position known commonly as tatehisa, with one knee up. And in truth, you know, there's the movie convention within Japan is a lot of seiza, with both knees down on the ground. And so we had historians telling us, no, but it has to be tatehisa for these women. And then movement advisors saying seiza, and actors saying seiza, because that's what they're used to, because that's where the convention is. And where we decided, first of all, I said, this is above my cultural pay grade. I'm going to leave it to our Japanese producers to just decide together what they wanted to do and then just let me know. But what they came to was authenticity, spiritual authenticity. What the Japanese audiences might expect of this show was in a lot of ways more important than necessarily getting the sort of that historically accurate detail right.
And I think the important thing to note about that specific instance is that the reason why I think our Japanese collaborators chose that seating position was because otherwise it would have been completely distracting to Japanese audiences and to the Japanese eye. And when we were speaking with one of the journalists in Japan for the Japanese premiere of Shogun, she would talk about various Western productions as simply being not bad, but simply being like, it was so funky and so certain things were so clunky too, that she never could fall into a story because she would always notice these tiny things that just completely made her world that she knows, it rendered it inaccessible to her. So I think that, you know, it sounds great in hindsight that we all came to this idea, but I think in truth, a lot of it is simply so that we can open up and allow for access to the story. We don't want to do the thing that will just be completely antithetical to Japanese viewers.
Do you think in the time since the original Shogun, do you think that audiences have changed and audiences' expectations have changed, and that lends to this objective that you guys had for your show?
Yeah, I think they have. But I also think it's kind of like what Rachel was saying, that everything has to be a gateway into story, that too often we might get confused with treating those pursuits that we did on this show towards authenticity as an end in itself, when really what it is it's something that makes, and this is where, yes, this increased representation that we try to invite on set, does it make for a better atmosphere? Absolutely. But the thing that everyone is missing with it, which I hope current day productions can stand as a symbol for, is that we do all this because if we listen to our collaborators in a very open way, it makes our stories better. It makes them more surprising. It makes them less predictable in the ways that it's always just like these movies we've seen before. It makes things unexpected in the kind of way that I look for when I'm going to see any story, is just show me something new. And there's no better way than showing something new than getting around the sort of monolithic gaze of Hollywood culture, just being kind of told to the perspective of, you know, an American audience assumes a certain mainstream, you know, that by inviting these voices in into reflecting an authenticity and truth, it's always got to be in service of telling a newer, better story.
The one way, though, I think that audiences have changed, and it, you know, in hindsight, we've been working on this for 5 years. So in hindsight, it feels incredibly and impeccably timed that this show came out when it did. But these days, people, I think, are not only primed to invite and welcome subtitling, right? They are hungry for it. And I mean, how kismet is that for us? Because we've got a lot of that on our show, a lot.
And you said you've been working on this for 5 years. I get the sense that you put a lot of heart and soul into it. Do you have a good story or a funny moment from production that you can share with our listeners?
How come you're looking at me?
I have my story in the sense that, you know, we were in Vancouver, British Columbia, for a year, a solid year. And we were staying downtown in a high rise. I think there were about 52 floors to our building, and we were very, very high up. And, you know, Vancouver is just a a skyline of these sky rises. And there's tons of buildings. And at some point during production, things were pretty difficult. I'm not going to lie, it was very challenging to be doing this. We had just had our second child, so it was tough. And then at some point one morning, I looked down and my dog is staring straight out the window. And sitting on our balcony was a peregrine falcon, which is, according to our falconer, not a common sighting, especially within an urban setting. And of all the high rises, of all the apartments, that peregrine falcon, and I taped it. We have tape of it because it sat there for about 12 minutes. It just sat there watching us. And I thought, well, of all apartments to choose, he chose ours. Yeah,
which was Tornado's falcon show.
Tetsuko, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, that was my little fun fact.
I guess what I was happiest with and the memories that I'll always hold are, you know, we shot this show during COVID and, you know, we had two kids in that time, and both daughters. And so they were very much COVID babies. And, you know, one of the greatest thrills was on the weekends getting to bring them to set when no one was there and getting to just go in and let them play in this giant playground that was feudal Japan. Our oldest daughter was playing on the Japanese galley built full scale to life. You know, those are the things that I always hold, you know, as a kid. I grew up on the mainland and I, you know, in the Northeast and not with a connection to the movie business. And I really saw movies as that playground that was a world very far away. And so there's no greater joy than getting to watch our kids play inside of our imaginations in real life. It was just a real fun moment that reminds you, no matter how hard production can be, that it's, we're just very lucky to be doing it.
We have been hearing from Shogun creators and executive producers Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo. You can stream all 10 episodes of the Shogun series on Hulu. There won't be a second season of the series because season one covered the entire Clavel novel. But Marks and Kondo did say if there were to be something in the world of Shogun worth telling, they'd consider bringing it to the screen in the future. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we take a look at a report by the American Cancer Society about the cancer rates among Asians and Pacific Islanders. Call our talkback line and leave us feedback, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to the shows on the HPR website or your favorite podcast platform. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman Pote. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music, Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.